Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight the topic of discussion is the recently finished or concluded series, The Marvelous Miss Maisel, which is about a woman who is divorced. She's the mother of two. She discovers immediately after her husband leaves her that she has a gift for stand-up comedy. This takes place in the late 50s and early 60s in New York City. It has won multiple Emmys, ran for 5 seasons, literally just concluded a couple weeks ago. And joining me for tonight's discussion are Perry Seibert. Say hello.
Tits up!
And Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Yeah, so, you know, this was a great show. I mean, I love it. It's funny. It's charming. It's thoughtful. It's everything. But we'll get into that. I do want to do what I always do with these shows, and I'll start with you, Aaron. How did we first come to the series?
I think I turned it on 2 days after the first season dropped on Amazon Prime because I was like, okay, what is this? Saw and loved the Gilmore Girls, saw that this was by the same, the Paladinos, and was like, what is this? Hour-long comedies, as I've said on this show before, are, I think, the most difficult thing in television to pull off, and I wanted to see if I could do it. And yeah. So the rest, I've been there since the beginning.
Yeah, you know, it's similar to me. I knew about the Paladinos. I had not watched Gilmore Girls. I had not seen it at that point. I was aware of Gilmore Girls. You know, I was there when they sneaked the pilot. So that's how long it's been since I'd seen the pilot. So I watched it literally just finished it just not too long before the show aired tonight. I was there when they started airing, or not airing, but when they dropped the whole series. So it was, you know, like with you, within a day or so of that. And I've been there ever since. Funny enough, my wife did not come to the show until after season 2 had started. I have to tell this story while I'm thinking about it. She and I were talking at the time, and she said, "So what's this Maisel show you said you like? Isn't that the one about the lounge singer?" I was like, "Lounge singer? No, she's a comedian." And she went, "What?" I thought, but that dress in the advertisements, she's a stand-up?" I said, "Yeah." And she went and watched it, except she started with the very first episode of the second season. And she called me, and she went, "What the hell is going on here? I thought you said this took place in New York. That they're in Paris?" I went, "Abort, abort, abort. How far in are you?" She said, "About 5-10 minutes." I said, no. You're look at what you started." And she went, "Oh, shit." And so she went and, just like I'm sure we all did, blazed through those episodes really quick, which is very unusual for her. She's one that likes to pace it out. And hey, that's her story, which I just had to tell because that's funny. So what about you, Perry? How did you come to the show?
I remember when this was coming. I'm a Gilmore Girls fan, which I came to that show late. I did not watch Gilmore Girls as it happened. And, I got into Gilmore Girls because of my oldest daughter. And I was like, yeah, I like Rachel Brosnahan. I remembered her from House Cards. So I'm like, yeah, I'll absolutely check this out. I love New York. I love comedy. Yeah, let's do this. And boy, how do you not keep watching after that first step? I've been all in
for real
from the very beginning as well.
for real. I mean, it really is a great show, and you know, I think it helps if you like New York. I think it helps if you like comedy, if you like that period. But, you know, beyond all that, it is just a really great story about characters. And, yeah, it's funny, but it also makes you think, but not in that a very special episode way that we used to get back in, say, the 80s and 90s, you know. Say, oh, I don't know, Tootie Gets a Bra. But
that was
it was. So, you know, that brings
never
me to this
it,
question, it'll go to you, Perry. Is this better as a comedy or a drama, or do you think that it really is a perfect blend of the two?
Well, I flash back to our Freaks and Geeks discussion. This is a comedy. There's no doubt this is a comedy. This is a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
The comedies
yeah.
have really serious stuff in them. That's totally fine.
Yep.
There's no one denies that. So yeah, this is a. I mean, if you came in, if I told you this was a drama, we're not talking about this show like we are for the last 6 minutes. This fails spectacularly as drama. It's just a spectacular comedy that happens to have fantastic dramatic stuff in it.
Mm-hmm. Aaron?
Comedy. Comedy is more than what it's about. Comedy is what it is. There is a lot of touching human moments in it. There is very real human drama that takes place. But like stand-up comedy, the best of stand-up comedy anyway, the pain is all in service of the laugh. And that is how the show works. It really is set up like a stand-up comedian would tell a joke. We don't always get the laugh until the end of an episode, but we always get the laugh because it always, nothing's pointless. Everything's there for a reason.
You know, that reminds me, I had a friend, he's been gone a long time now, but he was a stand-up, and I can't help but think that he would have loved this show, because so much of what I know about stand-up, on, you know, beyond just what you find out, you know, by watching it, comes from many conversations and helping him prepare shows and taking him to gigs and watching him at work. You know, I just think he would have loved this show. I really can't help but think that he would have really thought that there was a lot of truth here. And yeah, that pain, you know, and the pain that Miriam has in the first episode, and as we find out, that existed before that, really drives the whole show.
And it's palpable. Like,
mm-hmm.
It is. They do not hide from the pain. They let you feel it, which is very admirable on the part of the Paladinos and all of their writers.
Yeah. So now, Aaron, how does this compare to other similar series?
I've never seen a show that I can truly call similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Perry brought up Freaks and Geeks, which is another of those Dodo Bird one-hour comedies.
Yes.
And obviously it has some Gilmore Girls DNA because of the Paladinos running it. I know that Hacks also is about a stand-up comedian, but I haven't seen Hacks, so I can't say how similar it actually is, so I can't speak to that one. But this show is just fresh. It's familiar. It's never distant, but it's so fresh. And everything it's doing is so immediate. I honestly can't say how it compares to other shows like it, because I don't think there are any other shows like it.
No. Perry?
I have a very technical answer to your question, and it's I'm going to answer it in a way you normally ask this question kind of differently, and so I'm going to answer it this way. If I tell you, as I've said before in the show, that I firmly believe that The Sopranos is the greatest show in the history of cable and that Mad Men is the greatest achievement in commercial TV, and take your pick at whatever network TV show you want to say is the greatest network TV, this is the greatest streaming show ever, right? I don't think there's anything close. There are some things that are currently running that may end up in the running. I don't really want to give them – I don't want to put them in the slot until they're over. Name a better streaming show.
I am trying to think of one, and I really would be hard pressed to put it. I'll get into this later, but it is probably the highest ranked streaming show. I mean, there are shows that now are concluded, and you can find them streaming, but. That were intended for streaming that got dropped, you know, all at once in a batch or were streamed once a week, like this occasionally was with seasons 4 and 5. That's something to think about. Yeah. It really is. It really, really is. And, you know, of course, I've always said this because you mentioned The Sopranos, and I've been watching that with my wife, and we're up into season 5 with her viewing of the show. But that show, if anybody ever wants to say that's the greatest show, period, I probably slightly prefer The Wire, but man, The Sopranos is an awesome achievement. but, you know, this all leads to your question, it's the question you're going to answer first, Perry, and that is, how does this compare to other Paladino shows?
So I think I've only watched Gilmore Girls thoroughly. I mean, I'm going back over, thinking back, I saw more of Veronica's Closet than I would have ever cared to. And I couldn't tell you for sure. I've never seen an episode of Bunheads. I would. My youngest daughter's a dancer. I would gladly watch this show. I just never have. I've never been a big Family Guy fan, if we're going to rope in Daniel. And so this is easily their best work. I have no problem saying that.
Mm-hmm. Aaron?
I am kind of in the same boat. I will say that she and Daniel probably wrote the very best of Roseanne.
Yes.
But I don't really like Roseanne. I appreciate what those two did on the series. But I don't really like the show. I do love Gilmore Girls, but this surpasses it. Because I think it's their wheelhouse. I think in Gilmore Girls, they were really trying to explore this world that they didn't understand. And this one, like, they were really... Amy Sherman Palladino's father was a stand-up comedian in New York in the 1950s. Like, this is her wheelhouse. This is her life.
Yeah.
And she's bringing in this feminist edge that she brings everywhere without ever just, like, her shows are not political, but they are feminist to the core. And here she is saying, this is what it took for Joan Rivers.
Yeah, and they're feminists without being man-hating or making apologies for women acting horribly towards anyone, including other women.
Yeah.
Which I think is the problem that I have with hacks. I think hacks makes the mistake of cheering on the two women as they're horrible to each other and then kind of sloughing it off at times by, well, they're women. Isn't it great that they get to do this? And I think Maisel was a much, I'll just say it, a much smarter and wiser brand of feminism.
Well, and it was never afraid to let you be disappointed in a decision that Mitch made, or
right.
And like you can say, okay, I get why she did that, but does she have to do it that way, or whatever the case may be? You like you cringe at Mitch, and the show cringes with you. Like the show does not shy away from the faults of its characters. But it embraces them. Like, they're not judging her for what she's doing. And they're even saying, hey, maybe this is necessary. But that doesn't mean it's good.
And I think that's
but it's
the great,
a crappy business.
And
what's
I think
that?
That's the great... Oh, sorry. Sorry, Ann. Don't step on you.
No, I'm done.
That and I think that's the great maturation from Gilmore Girls. Because I think the flaw in Gilmore Girls is that they like both Lorelai and Rory way too much.
the mother in Gilmore Girls pisses me off. The daughter's a little jerk, but the mother's a fucking idiot. There she has two wonderful parents who literally aren't asking her to do anything for them. That they aren't telling her, well, we'll do this for you if you do this for us. We're so disappointed. No, they're literally the most wonderful people ever. And she's going, wow, I'm going to run away and live in a shack. Fuck you.
How much did you watch? Because they are not wonderful people.
They're
not.
I watched the first season and then gave up. I was like, fuck
it. It gets better. And I like it from season one. I also love Gilmore Girls. I'm with you, Aaron.
Yeah, I just couldn't put up with the shit after a season. I was like, oh, fuck this. But my patience for anybody whining, and it's probably something I inherited from my mother. My mother and father both, but my mother especially would always sit and watch something with me, and if anybody was starting to whine or complain, or if there was a horror movie and somebody started just screaming, oh, she had a problem with it. I think that really has affected the way that I view things. So, you know, there's that too. So it's just something I'm aware I inherited it just like, hey, my friend that I mentioned that's a comedian, I know that he and I, part of the reason we became friends, we watched gangster movies in the same way, and we bonded over that, and then we ended up influencing each other in the ways that we watched it. So, watched them, so, you know. Hey, we could probably do a whole show on the ways, on that sort of, there's a topic. No, there's a whole paper. Now that we've kind of gotten this baseline backstory framework set up, What themes are present here? Perry?
I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give you three. Aside from, obviously, as you've said, as we've talked about already, it's absolutely a show about what it's like to be a woman. Let's be real clear that that's never – the title of the show gives that away. That's crystal clear. That said, within that giant circle, I think it does three things – I think it returns to three things really interestingly and often. I am fascinated by the willingness to show and force you to accept I don't have a good phrase for it, but I want to say the core shallowness of every single person in your life. Like there's nobody in this show that is there is no selfless person in this show. There are people who absolutely are less selfish than others, but there is a core selfishness and self-centeredness to everybody in the show, and I love that the drama comes from when those moments of what people need for themselves collide. That's really and they do it consistently and regularly, and it's like, you know, it's like billiard balls on a table. They ram each other and croom off, and sometimes they're in perfect unison, and sometimes they are not. And that they figured out how to shuffle so many characters into this and to do this over and over and over and never make it feel dull or repetitive is really brilliant. And the other thing I will say, and this is ties into that, it's a show about the power of telling the truth, because that's the key to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The stand-up persona, right? It's because she's not Phyllis Diller. She's not Joan Rivers. She doesn't get up and tell jokes. She talks about her life. She wants to do what Lenny Bruce does. And that there's no comic like that in that time period. There's no one like that. There's no female avatar for that person in real life. For a show steeped in real showbiz history, there is no corollary to that. And so that's a really interesting mix. And I thought of this earlier as we've been talking about it, and I was thinking about this question specifically and getting at the fact that it is fascinating to me that this show gets away with being about an artist who is finding their voice, and it's made by a show creator who had the voice of the show down second one of season one of episode one. The show never discovers itself. It knows what it is right from the start. And that's really brilliant. But Amy Sherman-Pelletier, you know, it would be so easy to talk down to your audience if you were that confident and knew where this was going to go and knew what it was. And she doesn't.
You know, I think it helps that, really, like you mentioned, her father was a stand-up, so it's something she knew. And also it's something that apparently she'd been working on the idea with her husband off and on for something like a decade before it went into production. So she had plenty of time to work out the kinks. From what I understand, they also went into it, not with the Straczynski 5-year plan, but knowing that they figured that within 5 or 6 years they'd be able to tell the story they wanted to tell. And I guess when COVID happened, that's when they decided, you know.
Yeah, I think they wanted 6.
It probably should end at 5 rather than 6. And I think that's part of why we got the structure. We can talk about that when we get to that question. But I think that's part of why we got the structure that we did in Season 5 is to make up for some of the stuff they would have given us in Season 6 but didn't because, productions being how they are now, they didn't want to chance it. So, Aaron, what are your thoughts on themes in Maisel?
Um, it's about navigating relationships when you are constantly under the microscope. Perry's right on every single thing he just said, and I think that that core selfishness is really interesting to think about, especially when you take into account Midge and the microscope she put herself under. Because all of a sudden, she's telling the truth about these idiosyncrasies that otherwise could just live and let live. But because she has to dissect it, and because she has to play with it, and because she has to expose it to this audience, all of a sudden they become bigger deals. Because you'll notice, most of the conflict in season one and then the first half of season two are twofold. Her and Joel and their very messy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And then her and her parents and her trying to keep them from finding out what she's gaslighting, how she's moonlighting. And because she knows that once they know what she's talking about, that it inherently changes the way she talks about it. It's quantum physics. Like, once something is observed, its behavior changes. And so once her family knows
anyone who has kids
that she's looking at them not just as parents, not just as family members, but as objects for her art, it
mm-hmm.
changes the way they act around her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excuse me. So we'll go with you next, Aaron, and we'll ask this. Who is your favorite character? And, you know, I guess if you have a tie or it's so close, you can mention your two favorite characters. But really, who is your favorite character?
I would be hard-pressed not to say Midge. It's her show. And Rachel... I can't say her name.
Brosnahan's
performance is pitch perfect in every episode.
Yes.
Separating myself from it being her show, I have to say Lenny Bruce.
Ooh.
He only comes in a couple times a season. But Luke Kirby is God in this show. That I am not sure there has ever been a better guest performance on a television program than he consistently gives.
Well, I will
every
say
season.
This. He's very good. He's excellent here. And this ties into our next question, but I have to say, and you and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago, but is it just me or did he do a better job here than Dustin Hoffman ever could have possibly thought to do in Lenny?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously he had a lot more time to develop the character. He also had better writing, let's be honest. Yeah, I'll just say it. Is he the best Lenny Bruce we'll ever get?
It may be the definitive performance.
So what about you, Perry? Who's your favorite character? Or do you have something to say to that? or
I'm
going
to veer us off topic for just a moment to say that, and I mean this honestly, I don't know that I could say this about any – there are very few shows I could ever say this about. You could answer anything to this question, and I could see your point. There is no one – there's no character not to adore on this show as a television character.
Yes.
Seriously.
Yes.
There's
yes.
no wrong answer.
Absolutely.
So I am going to, and I will now write for you exactly what I wrote down after that about this question for my notes. I will tell you that no performance on television has given me more pure joy over the last 6 years than Luke Kirby as Lenny Bruce. And I will tell you that, yes, you will never get a better Lenny Bruce. I will tell you that, yes, it's a better Lenny Bruce than Dustin Hoffman's Lenny Bruce, and that's not Dustin Hoffman's fault. That's the scope of what's being told, right?
Right.
I absolutely adore Bob Fosse, but Bob Fosse wanted to always show the rotten core at the heart of entertainment. And so that's what that Lenny Bruce did, and that's a fine way to deal with Lenny Bruce. I have no problem with the movie. I like the movie. I like Hoffman in the movie a great deal. But... that moment, I can't remember, is it season 2 or season 3 where we get him on, I think it's Jack Parr, where he does that stand-up, that really incredibly song piece that he really did.
Yeah, I think it's season 3.
That's taken from, that happened. So, and that's
yeah.
why it is, that's why it is the absolute gift from God to the Paladinos. That they got somebody who, from what I understand, actually like loves Lenny Bruce and knows the Bruce history and knows the Bruce routine. Like Luke Kirby's a fan and came in already with all of that. But to have somebody who then can, as we talked about earlier, be the actual historical figure that grounds this in a world that is not grounded in reality, it's grounded in this wonderful fictional world that's created. But that grounds it to, okay, there is now a timeline on this. This is not going to be a Tarantino world where he lives.
Right.
What is the story? Why are we comparing, why are we asked to think about Midge and Lenny Bruce simultaneously? It allows the show, I think, the depth beyond the wonderful writing, beyond the relationships that the show is looking for. Anything you want to think about entertainment-wise, you've now got it. And Luke Kirby and the brilliant writing of the Lenny Bruce character in this series gives them that. It's
yeah, and he's won an Emmy or two
really
for this.
Special.
Rightfully so.
Yes, rightfully
just one criminally, but
I thought it was two. Was it two?
No, I just looked it up. It was just in the first season that he won it for. When they cleaned up that first season.
Okay. For some reason, I was thinking he had won again. But
I thought he had two, but I was just looking up to see which other season he won for, and it doesn't look like he did.
I thought he won a supporting and a guest, but maybe not.
Yeah, you know, this question is interesting, and I actually have a. You know, this is interesting. I actually have so many characters that I could say is a favorite. You know, Lenny Bruce is great. And maybe because you guys have chosen that, I'll go with my tie for second. Because I had a tie for second. I had Lenny first, and then I had a tie for second. So I'm going to go with my... with my tie, and those are the Maisels, and by that I mean Shirley and Moish. What those two did with that material, we didn't get to see them much in season one. They began to develop them in season two. By season three, they were awesome. By season four, they were sometimes the best part of any episode. And the shit they did in season five is eternal. but you know, like we said, there are so many great characters. There are so many characters to love. I mean, even though they're not necessarily the nicest people, I find some of the Chinese gangsters running the gambling pot corner,
yeah,
even though they're very tiny parts, very interesting characters. Frank and Nikki, not nice guys, but fucking amazing characters. Fucking amazing characters. So we will... yeah, what was that?
We haven't even touched on Susie and Abe.
Right.
I know. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, we love them all, but this kind of became a, hey, let's give a shout out. Now we come to this part, and I'll go with you, Perry. Who is the MVP of the show?
The problem is my answer for this in my head is totally stuck with another question that you haven't asked yet. So can I defer? When we get around to the
can
question,
you,
I know you
is there any
ask.
Way you can split it?
I will. How about if I give you my answer now and my explanation when you get around to it?
Sure.
Would you accept that? The answer to the question is very, very lazily and obviously Amy Sherman-Palladino. But I will wait to get into details until we get around to a question that I know is going to come.
Yeah. Now, I will make this very specific and re-ask the question. Who is the MVP of the cast?
Oh, well, I think it's pretty apparent my answer there would be Luke Kirby. But obviously, yes, as Aaron beautifully put it earlier, it's Rachel Brosnahan's show. Again, there isn't one. They're all MVPs. Put them all on Mount Rushmore of the show. It's like I don't. there isn't. They are all first among equals. It's to even, you know, and someone who gets no love from an acting standpoint on this show, whose name you never hear, to the point that I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name for sure. Is it Zegan? Michael Zegan is fantastic. He's really fantastic as Joel. In what is
in a thankless role,
the closest thing to a thankless role, exactly, in the entire series, and it's even not
because he's
for most of the first two seasons. He gets the redemption arc that no one else gets. Like
right, the
fact that you can stomach looking at him by the end of the show, and spoilers, sorry. The fact that you can feel warm fuzzies when you see the wedding photo that reveals that they got remarried in the final episode tells you everything you need to know about how far Joel has come in the series.
And for me, it's not even that he has to come far. And now, granted, I might feel different. I went back and rewatched those first two seasons. I haven't. But I will say this, as we were talking about earlier about, you know, everybody's selfishness on display, he, I believe, pays the largest price for what is, in the grand scheme of things, one of the smallest acts of selfishness in the show. Having this incredibly brief affair, as I remember it.
With the dumbest woman in the world.
With the dumbest woman in the world, right. Like, that's... This should be a forgivable mistake in the grand scheme of things. Among the mistakes,
I mean,
show.
Come on, this is a woman that's so dumb. She probably didn't even realize she was having sex as she was having it.
That's another thing. That's another reason I love the whole show. That character turns into far and away the most selfless character in the bunch for having committed, you know, arguably the smallest of personal infractions that are committed against people on this show. I think it's pretty great. It comes close to a heroic death
by the end of it all.
So, yeah, again, I'm not saying he's the MVP acting-wise, but it's a really great character, and he never, ever disappoints in it.
Yep. You know, I can't disagree with any of that. And because you mentioned all that, I'm going to go in a different direction just to spread the discussion around. I'm going to have to go with Tony Shalhoub. There are very few things in the last 10 or 20 years on television as funny as Tony Shalhoub in a beret, smoking a pipe, talking philosophy, literature, and politics in a Parisian cafe early in season 2 of Maisel. It's a brief scene. It's a moment I'll never forget. He nailed it, and he consistently did so much with, honestly, at times, so little. It's not that the writing was shallow, but sometimes, you know, you'd watch an episode, and I usually would watch it with my wife. There were one or two times where I had to watch it, and then she watched it after, and as I'm watching it with her, I'm thinking to myself, damn, I remembered Abe doing a lot more in this episode, but he's only in it about 5 minutes. And, you know, that really shows you how good Shalhoub was. And he's very generous in terms of what he gives his acting partners in this show. He was the same in Monk, but maybe more so here. So, you know, he's my MVP. I mean, you could go with Alex Borstein. She's phenomenal as Susie. You could go with Rachel Brosnahan. She's, you know, she's in some ways she is the show. But, yeah, for me, it's Tony Shalhoub. So what about you, Aaron? Who's your MVP?
It's Rachel Brosnahan. If you were not in love with Midge Maisel by the end of the first episode, the show is never going to work.
Right.
You had to be crushed the way she was, that something happened to her that happened off screen that you didn't know with this character that you met 15 minutes ago. And you had to be destroyed by it so that you could be picked up by it. She carries it. Like, she has all the help in the world with the writers and the directors and the rest of the cast. But if she is not giving as good of a performance as she gives throughout this series, it's never going to work. Because it is the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That being said, everything around her is also perfect. It's hard to imagine the show with anyone different in any single role. But she's the linchpin, and if that doesn't work, the whole show fails. So just by design, I have to say it's her.
Now to you, Perry, for our next question, and that is, I'm pretty sure we pretty much all loved almost the entire series, with little bits here and there. What was your least favorite storyline? Like, let's say there are 100 storylines in the show, and you loved all of them. Just which one was the least favorite? Which one was the one that you're kind of like, yeah, you know, they could have done without that one. Not that it was necessarily bad, but just it's the one that you liked the least.
I thought long and hard. And the only answer I can give, and I think this has to do with the fact that, and as I understand it from interviews with Amy Paladino, Amazon told her this was over. She was not prepared to end this after 5. So that the whole structure of season five is because they were told it's ending now. As she so beautifully put it, there are a lot of orcs to pay for. A fantastic line. I think that she's the only storyline that gets really short shrift is May and Joel, right? Because suddenly that just screeches to a halt.
Yeah, I really didn't like the way
that
ends.
It's not that I don't like it. I'm glad it's there. I wanted more of it. I like it, so I don't like it because it's so cut short.
Well, part of
that they had to because of Amazon.
Well, but also because she was doing award circuit for Everything Everywhere All at Once, right? Like, she just didn't have the time in her schedule.
Possibly, but I would rather blame Amazon. So,
that's
I'll
fair.
Blame Amazon.
That's fair.
I'll blame Amazon. Yeah, everything I'd always heard was that Paladino had come to a decision to finish it in five, but if it's coming out now that it wasn't solely her decision, yeah, that burns me. It doesn't surprise me at all. Does not surprise me at all. I have to say the end of that really did irk me. I was like, wait, what? They're taking this great character and all this potential and what? Because I was looking forward to seeing that storyline play out, even if it only played out in like two or three episodes and ended poorly like I expected it would. I wasn't expecting one little like 5-minute scene and that's it. What the fuck? That's a horrible ending for it. I'm not going to say that it's a bad storyline because I love the storyline
right.
up to
exactly.
the point, but the ending that was not what I wanted. But you know what I want and what I get are two different things. So,
exactly.
Aaron, what about you?
I have to agree. I don't think I even had an answer before Perry gave his, so I'm glad he went first on this one. The ending felt rushed, the ending to the May story. We knew it was over as soon as she had the abortion, but it still deserved probably at least a full B story, if not two B story episodes, to really give us, I think, the proper ending to that story. Like, it had really been built up through season four, the way that she was with Joel through the Moish health scare,
and she was kind of, in some ways she was another Midge.
Yeah.
She's absolutely like the catalyst for his redemption, right? Like, oh, all of a sudden Joel is mature. Like, he's a mature adult ready to have an adult relationship. And like, you realize how young they were at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
And like, he was not ready to be a settled down father of two when all of the temptations of 1950s New York and powerful men, as we saw on Mad Men, which has already been brought up a few times, were being thrown at him. He didn't have it in him to turn that down. And now he does, and we can see that because, well, May will break his neck, but also because he's changed, and it's the first time that we really get to see how much he has changed.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, now I'm going to come to... this, and I'll go with you, Aaron. What is your favorite storyline in the series?
You know what? I might take a little bit of heat here. I loved the way, and this is not a single story, I loved the way they made us work in season 5. I loved the way they played with the timeline, so we never really knew what was cause and what was effect and where the story was going to land until it landed. And they made us, they said, we gave you 4 incredible seasons, and you're going to have to trust us to stick the landing. And they stuck it. They stuck it hard.
Yeah, I
was
weeping
at the end of
question.
The finale.
Yeah.
But I love the way they said, you stuck with us for 4, stick with us for 1 more, and we'll make it worth it. But you're going to have to work for it.
Yep. That basically, you like that final redemption arc told over a period of, probably like 25 years of flash forwards, 30 years. Yeah. That was pretty interesting stuff. Perry, you?
I just want to add to that. They not only stuck the ending, they stuck all 3 endings.
Yeah.
She obviously couldn't. She couldn't kill her babies. Like, she needed all of them, and they're all worth it. So I'm fine with that. Again, as you've been saying throughout tonight, there's no bad choice here, right? And so I picked 2 that surprised me the most satisfactorily.
Yeah, and that's why I said
the most
favorite, not best.
Okay.
So we could choose ones that we liked the most.
I don't even want to say these are my favorites, but they're the ones that were like, I am so glad you did this little chunk of time on this show. I cannot remember which season it is. Whatever the season, the arc where Susie gets Sophie Lennon on Broadway is not only screamingly funny, just straight up, that's just great comedy.
I believe
it
that's season 3.
I think I would have guessed 3. It is the point at which you really see the extent of Susie's desire for success outside of Midge, right? It's back to the self-centeredness thing. Like, that's the moment where I realized, oh, she really does have grand designs of her own. I mean, they talk about it, but it feels like a character thing. It's like, oh, is she going to be famous? It's the first time where I really started to consider, oh, Midge is just a tool. It's a tool she cares about and loves. But, yeah, and that she has this great adventure without her is fabulous. And Jane Lynch is spectacular throughout. I love that whole arc, and I love how it pays off, because it pays off in a way that is obvious. You should see that coming.
Yeah, I will just
and
have
yet,
to say
I,
that,
I
this, that this show did give me a new appreciation of Jane Lynch.
So good. She's good. And I will tell you the other moment, and it's not an arc. It's not an arc. It's a scene. It is the scene that I have probably replayed the most in the entire run of the show, because it is everything the Paladinos do well. It is so fast. It is so, His Girl Friday delivered. The timing of everything is so good. And sometimes it's the edits and sometimes it's the performances. I can watch Susie and Rose at the Tea Room all day long.
Oh, man.
That scene is
just
so
incredible.
Funny. I will take that as the single, that is the single greatest comedic scene.
And you're reminded of that scene when the Tea Room burns down, and then Susie's like, what, the Tea Room? My Tea Room? Our Tea Room?
That they brought it back.
Those motherfuckers.
Yes. That they paid it off, that they called it back, made me so incredibly happy. Yes, so I just wanted to bring those 2 moments up when I saw your question. That's what came to mind immediately.
Yeah, Yeah, you know, there are lots of stories, but, you know, we kind of touched on it. And I think the one that I'm the most impressed with, the one that maybe gave me, you know, the most joy was seeing such an asshole like Joel started out being properly redeemed. You know, so often in films and television, they rush things. They gloss things over. You get redemption, but it's not fully earned. You know, it feels like in between seasons shit happened that you're missing. It never felt like that here. And I think that ultimately that was maybe my favorite long-running story on the show. You know, I also, you know, I started out having some issues with something that we'll get into in a moment, but I also really liked that as well. So, Perry, I'll ask you this question. The final season has a very unique, you know, especially for series presentation. It's something that I'd only seen once or twice before. And the question was going to be, did it work for you? But I can tell that based on what you said with Aaron, it did. So did it work? And explain.
Of course it works. Of course it works. Explain why it works. Oh, if I could do that, I could write television.
Well, why it worked for you. Tell us why it worked for you.
Oh,
what about it
fair.
Made it work for you?
It, part of it is the sheer audacity of thinking, oh, this could go terrible. Like at no point in the previous seasons did I think, oh, this is going wrong. This could go very badly suddenly. I don't know. What are you doing for sure? And not that it was that bad out of the gate to see this, but it was like, all right, you're going to take a giant swing here. I hope it goes out of the park.
I was a little nervous those first two episodes. It wasn't that I was hating the show. Like I told Aaron, it was where the show is usually like a 9.8 to a 10. Those first two episodes were feeling more like a 9.2, 9.3 to me. But that third episode, it really starts to come together, and it just got better and better for me. So, yeah, I had some you know, little issues to begin with. There's only one other time that I can really remember a series playing with time this way and doing it as effectively, and that's season 4 of China Beach, where they take the characters 5, 10, 15, 20 years into the future, and it works there, and they jump around. You know, you'll go back, you'll go forward. It's not just a chronological, okay, so now we're in 1976, now we're in 1981, now it's 1983, now it's 1984, now it's 1990. Nope, it's not like that. And they did that, I think, to show the way that trauma affects people, and particularly this group of people and what the war really wrought on their psyche. And it's also the season that took that show from being a very good series to being an all-time series. That final season is fucking amazing. So I take it that, Perry, you're also a China Beach fan?
No, I know the show and I know your affection for it. And so that was what I was expecting you to say.
Oh.
And I couldn't think of another show.
Okay, because I was
going to
say, if you've seen
like
it, you want to do a show on it, I'm definitely up for that. at some point.
I would love to see the show. I've never seen the show in full. I knew of it. It was one of those shows that at the time I wished I watched it. I've never hunted it down. That's on me. I will say
it's available on DVD and actually not too expensive.
I will say this for my – I had no qualms about it was, the only qualms I had were the writing. Like, are you going to be able to pull this off? Because I will say they started off so well with the daughter in therapy. That actress, whoever that is phenomenal.
Just perfect.
Oh, she's
doing
terrific.
At doing the perfect, like, it's Abe and Midge. It's the perfect fusion. It's a spectacular piece of work out of that actor.
Yep. And by the end of that season, you know, this season of Maisel, yeah, it worked. Really worked. I those last three episodes, the finale, but also the Testarossa deal, where you got to see what happened, why Susie and Midge are no longer speaking, and, you know, that was just perfect. Now, my wife actually had some issues with that episode. She actually had some issues with the season as a whole. She always liked to imagine that the show existed in a fantasy version of New York, a fantasy version of the 60s. And by putting Susie and Midge into the situations those flash forwards did, it destroyed the fantasy for her to a degree, which I can kind of see that, but, you know, for me, it works. I think it's where the show would have gone. This is part of what I mean by what we would have gotten in a sixth season. I'm still not convinced that we wouldn't have gotten some flash forwards, or that we wouldn't have gotten episodes with time jumps in season six.
Totally.
But I do think that what we got was an awesome ending. So, Aaron?
What can I say? It's a puzzle box, and I saw from the very beginning of the season that it was a puzzle box, and that I was going to have to give my faith over to that, because I knew we weren't going to have answers until the end. And that's the biggest thing with season five, is you have to have liked, I think, how do I say this? I don't think that if you're on the fence about this show that you're going to stick through season five. You have to trust that the show knows what it's doing in order to follow it. But the payoff is so immense if you're willing to give into it and say, okay, you haven't let me down before. I trust you implicitly. Like, I think the payoff, the emotional payoff for each and every character is just stunning if you give into it and just let yourself go with it. I loved the way that they played into the fact that everyone is nervous about Midge that's shy since the end of season three, when Midge really has her most epic screw up of the series. No one has let her off the hook for anything she does. That's remotely.
Well, what happens at the end of season three resonates for the next two seasons.
Right.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. Like, it's a major screw up, but she does grow up a lot in those last two seasons. But they play into the fact that no one really trusts Midge after that. And they let you think that she's the bad guy the first two or three episodes. It's really not until the end of the third episode where you see her interaction with her son in the 80s where you're like, wait a second, this is not the character I thought they were building.
You know, I have to say, Abe was right. Oh, my God, my grandson's an idiot. Because,
yeah.
My God, only an idiot would think that woman was a decent woman, the one that he married. What a horrible, horrible, horrible person Ethan's wife turned out to be.
I mean, my God. I think that they were very wise, by the way. We've all mentioned episode 3 as being, like, I was willing to go with it, like, give them the whole season. But I think that third episode is such a turning point that they were very wise to dump the first 3 episodes at once. I think they knew that they might lose some people if they didn't give them that third episode immediately. And the rest of it, you're like, after that third episode, you're like, okay, they know what they're doing.
Let me interrupt here to just say this. My wife, as much as she loves the show, she and I sat and we watched the first 2 episodes, and then we were going to watch the third, but she wasn't sure about it. And she said, yeah, I think we'll just watch it tomorrow, which we did. And she wasn't really into it because of her problems with the first 2 episodes, but that third episode brought her back. So I definitely think that there's something there. They could have lost some audience, even some real diehards.
I'm going to argue for the fact that I don't think that Ethan's wife is horrible. I think that's exactly what he needs, is someone who he knows isn't going to leave. I mean, I like the fact that, like, the joke that he's happy, right, in preschool, he's one of the happiest children we've ever had here. And that's supposed to be this dismissive, you know, takedown. I don't know. I watched the scene a couple of times. I can't tell if he's happy in the kibbutz or not. I don't really know. He might be.
Stupid people are often. No, I'm not going to get into that.
Right. No, then you're playing. No, yeah. Then I think you're playing a game that's too easy. I don't think the show is being that obvious about it. That's how Abe wants you to read it, for sure. But I give that
Abe has a really interesting storyline in season 5, but we'll get into that a little bit later. Sorry. Sorry about this, Aaron. So please finish your thought. Sorry about interrupting.
I was mostly done. But
okay.
I don't need to wrap it up. I know.
No, wrap it up, please.
I'm okay with where that ended. I think they knew that they were taking a huge swing. And I think they also knew that they hit a home run. But
yeah,
they knew that they had to get people all the way invested in the new look, the new delivery, in order to fully have people invested. And I think that one of the best decisions they made was in doing the 3-episode dump at the beginning of season 5.
Yeah. This is actually a season where, you know, it can be argued that it both worked for and against the show by not having the entire season all at once. You know. And you know, a lot of streaming shows, I do think they are built to be seen all at once, to pick at them at your leisure. And
it's more of
this
cinematic
this is,
style.
Yeah, and this show is usually no different. But this season, you know, maybe there's some build up by that, but maybe also there's something lost. You know, I guess you could have, if you were a viewer and you had seen the first 4 seasons, you could just wait until it's all over and then watch it all at once. But I do wonder what that experience would be like. But yeah, you know, I think Abe goes on a hell, and there was something Perry said and something you said that made me think Abe goes on a hell of a character arc here. That final scene in the next to last episode where he's sitting with the other guys and he realizes, or he talks about how he's come to the realization that he ignored his daughter in place of his son, and his daughter is at least as amazing as his son, and that the happiness of Ethan and the brilliance of of Esther is something that really gets him thinking. And I am so glad they did not go for, you know, the easy thing that you're thinking, because, you know, you see her get the call at the end of that episode and you think, okay, well, Abe just had that scene of revelation. He's going to be dead or he's going to die, and that's going to be that, and that's how they're going to end the show. And they didn't. And they actually do get that really nice moment where he doesn't exactly apologize, but he lets her know that he could have done better. And that,
well,
he appreciates,
you know, that
her.
He couldn't have died because he was at the wedding to Philip Roth that never happened.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. That's right. There, that is right, because that did happen.
Yeah.
Yep. But, you know, there could have been any other number of deaths, and that's the other thing. You know, you're thinking,
yeah,
are they going to kill off Abe? Are they going to kill off, is it going to be like Moisture Shirley? Is it going to be,
I always,
you know, I don't know,
thought the show would
anybody
end with Lenny Bruce's death.
Right.
I always thought they'd end it with Lenny's death.
But,
and they do without doing it.
Yes. They do. I think they played it better than they could have. They could have let it go wrong.
Yep.
By actually showing him die, instead they let it. They showed his career dying, and
yep,
you can put the pieces together yourself.
Speaking of that Roth wedding, you know, Abe's little. He's such a funny man. He's such a nice man. He gave me a whole collection of all of his books signed. He signed them for me.
Did she marry Paul Simon, or did she just date Paul Simon?
Yeah. Well,
well,
you know, the thing that got me in that episode is when it was September of 73, I think, or is it December? Anyway, the month is important because one of the people that was scheduled to go to that wedding and perform was Jim Croce, who in real life, as I understand it, you know, we all know he died in a plane crash, but from what I understand, he was on his way to a private event at the time. So the show's kind of like saying, yeah, he died on his way to Midge's wedding, and it didn't happen. You
well,
killed
you
Jim Croce!
If you know anything about Philip Roth's next couple of novels, he has some doozy of women in the next couple of novels after that point. And they mentioned that Susie Meyerson was the basis of the women in those
several
books. And
yes. It
just totally changes the way you read some of these books. Thinking about Susie as the characters.
Well, now try putting her voice to those characters.
Exactly.
Amy might have been giving up her influences there. She might have just been confessing to where she got the whole idea.
Yeah. So I think we'll get to this last of the questions that we prepared for, and that will be this. And I'll go to you, Perry. I'll go with Aaron because you got to start the last one. So, is this ultimately a triumph of writing, directing, production, or acting?
Yes. I make that joke a lot, but I seriously don't think I have an answer to this one. This is a show that is at times literally perfect. I won't say that it never slips, that it never falls. What show doesn't in the course of 40 some episodes over 6 years and 5 seasons, but, The writing is peak, but the writing is peak because the actors are peak. And the actors are peak because the direction is peak. And the direction is peak because everything looks perfect. And everything in the show drives itself. And I truly do not have an answer to this time. Usually on a TV show, at the end of the day, if push comes to shove, I settle on writing. I can't do that this time. And the writing's spectacular. It's just that everything is at the same level. It's constantly pushing itself further.
Yeah, I'm with you here. Now, I do want to say this, and you were talking about, you know, the directing, pushing the production and all that. And I'm going to mention my wife again, and I'm going to have to because she'll kill me if I don't mention this, and I think this is an interesting point. But she said, watch how background characters, extras, walk, how they seem to almost dance. And she said apparently they hired dancers. They hired people and they actually did choreograph it like a musical. And that is very apparent in some scenes. And it really gives the show a visual energy that is unique.
Just vibrant. Constantly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, Perry?
I love that we've swapped roles on this question because I'm actually going to answer it. I'm the one who usually punts on this. With the obvious answer, yes, there isn't a wrong choice here. But I'm going to go back to the MVP question. This is a marvel of production, specifically television production, which, as we all know, even more than film, is the writing. The producers are overseeing everything on a TV show, and so this is an artistic vision we don't see often in TV for all the reasons you were getting at. This is a marvelous looking show. This is a marvelous looking show in every conceivable way. It's shot well and inventively. There is not a single set to me that looks like a set. It does, but it feels real and lived in or worked in. Nothing feels like it's there to show off. Even Grand Central in the last season, it's a moment to see, yeah, we're in Grand Central, and then we have this fantastic scene between Susie and Midge in it. It's not about showing off. I think it's part of the reason the show, Amazon cut this show, is really expensive, and all that money is on the screen.
And yes, Amy Sherman-Palladino and her husband oversaw a brilliant writing staff that delivered, you know, page after page. They cast it to perfection, and so all of that pays out from that. So I am going to answer production on this because it does feel, as we've been saying from the beginning, this show knew what it was from moment one, and that it doesn't feel discovered. It doesn't work out some kinks to get there. It's there.
Yeah,
right,
you know, and that's
start.
Not to say that it's that the writing is bad or the directing
exactly.
is bad or the acting is bad, or that because the production may be the best thing about it that the others are somehow off, that it's like
right.
we're giving an A to production, and well, that means we're giving B's and C's to everything else. No, it's A's across the board, but there's something really special about the production itself, and that ties in maybe a little bit with directing. You know, but you look at the sets and the makeup and the costumes, the period detail is fucking incredible.
Can I
just
say
yeah.
that in a lot of ways, this is auteur TV.
No question.
Yeah.
And like this, that like, it, is it a triumph of writing, directing, acting, production? Yes, it's a triumph of Amy Sherman-Palladino, and her thumbprint is on every frame of every episode, and that's like you don't see that in TV often, like even in like David Simon. Is maybe the only other guy I can think of who, like, and he doesn't direct, from the writer's chair alone has that kind of influence. Like, this is Atlanta, which the three of us discussed earlier this year, and Barry, which we're going to discuss soon. Those are also similar in that this way, that it's the vision of a single creator, and they have help. We can't deny that, but the vision is singular, and it's what's really created this golden age of television comedy that is really tragically coming to an end all at once.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it really, really is. Hell, the new golden age of television. You know, you look at Saul ending and Atlanta ending, Maisel, Barry, Russian Doll. Although that was never a big part in terms of. Yep, there's Ozark.
Succession.
Other shows.
As much as you don't care for it.
I have my issues
and
with Succession.
And can I point out?
And
that,
it's mainly that the show. Hold that thought. And it's mainly that the show. It's not that it's a bad show. It's just that I can never help but get the feeling that the people that say, oh, my God, this is the best thing since the invention of the orgasm, have probably only ever seen about two or three TV shows. Now, I have no problem if you think it's a great show, but don't try telling me it is incontrovertibly the best thing in the history of television, folks. Come on. But, as we were.
Can I
and
just
that wasn't directed at you, Perry, just so you know, that wasn't directed at you. That was directed at
the
other people.
And I've never said that about the show. but I've said it's a brilliant show that I think, like Gilmore Girls, you shouldn't have given up on after season one.
I didn't so much give up on it as I just didn't feel compelled to see more. But now that it's over, now that it's over and there is a definite end, maybe this summer I'll get to it. Maybe not. Depends on some stuff. I've got a lot to do this summer. Oh my God! Just the schedule we have on this show alone, not to mention the fact that I'm really trying to wrap up the research on my TV. You know, that's finally coming around. I'm trying to stick to my deadline for that. So, yeah. And who knows, that may actually be the perfect excuse to finally force myself to finish that show so that I can see if it's worthy of inclusion or not. But I think before we go to the end game...
Ken.
Yep, go on.
Can I just say something real quick?
Mm-hmm.
The show has 43 episodes and only 6 directors. That
wow.
is a tiny
yeah.
stable. The Paladino
wow.
directed 35 of the 43 episodes. And Amy directed 21 of them. That's
wow.
half the series she directed by herself. And that's just unheard of in a show with this kind of scale, both cast and production, like production wise. Just to put into perspective what we're talking about when we talk about how singular the show is.
Oh no. You know, I mean, we've had some auteurs in TV, you know, and it's almost always a writer-producer. It's very seldom a writer-producer-director. You know, there's David Lynch with Twin Peaks, who wrote, produced, and directed.
Mm-hmm.
There's Straczynski with Babylon 5, who wrote, produced, and then directed the final episode, but you can't really call him a director. There's David Simon, who's a producer and a writer, and apparently has told his directors, yeah, don't look at me.
But also, the writer's room, only 9 writers over the 43
yep.
episodes as well. So.
Yep. And I was going to say, there's also David Chase, who wrote, produced, and directed The Sopranos, and Matthew Weiner, who wrote, produced,
yeah.
and directed episodes of Mad Men. So, yeah, you're not wrong. But the fact that she did 21 episodes out of 43, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That is really something. I mean, I'm going to have to go back to Straczynski. That's almost as impressive as his streak of... writing all but
writing
like 1.5 episodes of the last 3 seasons of Babylon 5.
Well, and Bill Hader, not to step on toes, directed every episode of the last 2 seasons of Barry. So
was it every episode? God, I thought there was at least
episode.
One. Because I could have sworn Hiro Murai did 1 episode in one of those seasons.
No, he directed every episode in the last 2 seasons.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that next week. We'll get to that next week.
Which is
but
a perfect
yeah,
segue
you know,
for.
Yeah, for our housekeeping. And this is where we get to talk about what's coming up on Deviant Legion. And what exactly is coming up on Deviant Legion? I'm glad you asked, folks, because on the 11th of June at 8 p.m., Rock This Town Radio with TC is going to be on an episode entitled An Evening with Jeff Fetterman. On the 12th at 8 p.m., Rock This Town Radio with TC will be back again with an episode entitled Marshmallow Overcoat Monday with Tyler Calkin. on the 20th of June, an episode simply entitled Joe Bartone. I'm assuming that's a Carl episode. And then Rock This Town Radio will finish up the month with an episode on the 25th, at also at 8 p.m., with an episode called Summertime with Lori. Now, this series, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back next week with an episode on the recently concluded HBO series, Barry. We will be back the week after that with an episode on Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And we do have plans to go weekly all throughout the summer. Now, that may change, probably won't, but, you know, life may get in the way. But we do have a lot of great episodes coming up, some things that have been really long in the works, some fun topics coming up, and some interesting directors, some directors that it's taken a while to finally get around to them, that I think people are going to enjoy hearing about. But, yeah, that is what is coming up the next 2 weeks on Cathode Ray Mission. So next week is Barry, and the week after that, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. So, you know, now that we've done the housekeeping, I have to ask, and I'll go to you first, Barry. Is there anything, as we start to wrap things up here, that we haven't mentioned yet that you would like to talk about before we go?
Two quick things, minor things, but they're people and things I adore. I love Jen Kirkman. I think Jen Kirkman is a fabulous comedian. Her second special on Netflix, Just Keep Living, is an outstanding hour. I highly recommend it. She's a producer on this from the beginning, and that makes me very, very happy that she was in that writer's room and that she had anything to do with this show. And I will also say, as someone who owes their ability exercise? No, that's a bad word. How about, I hate the word process when it comes to emotions. As someone who has a very hard time expressing and admitting to feelings of anger, I am a lifelong Elvis Costello adorer, because that's what teenage Perry learned, that's how I can still be articulate and very angry at the same time, and it's okay.
Well, if you're an Elvis Costello fan, then you probably loved the pilot for Treme, didn't you?
I've never watched it. I have not watched Treme. I talked about this with you, that if we...
You're the one that hasn't seen it.
I would rip through that thing. Absolutely. I need the reason to. That the last song in the first and last episode where girls talk, superb Elvis Costello song, the pilot ends with the Dave Edmonds version, which is definitive, and the finale ends with the Tegan and Sarah version. They're both excellent. That made me so – like, I'd already watched, like, the best first episode of anything I've seen in years, and then I get the best cover that exists of a really good Elvis Costello song. No wonder I love this show.
Yep. So, Aaron, anything that you want to mention before we get going?
I want to mention that I've never been more grateful that I'm not an Emmys Award voter this year. With Barry, Atlanta, and Mrs. Maisel all ending, and knowing that, like, they have to do right by one of these shows. I mean, they've all gotten their due over the years. Barry and Atlanta have never won a series, so at least one of them is going to remain winless in that category.
Here's the thing.
It's the Emmys, so they'll screw it all up anyway. But
well,
I'm just glad that I don't have to have that on me.
No, I'm with you. But here's the thing for me. I can't help but think, you know, Emmy voting habits and trends have changed so much. You know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I would have said, well, you know, Maisel has won, so that means it's going to have to be Barry or Atlanta, and, you know, then you put in other factors, you know, which show was more talked about, which show maybe the Emmy voters thought would have better, quote-unquote, optics, and then you have to decide on a spoiler, you know, is there a more traditional show, like, say, Abbott Elementary that could come in and win, something that's been around that's considered a veteran show that's in, say, season 3 or 4, something like Hacks that hasn't won. It's going to be a bloodbath. You know, any of these three shows could win and be very deserving. You know, and I just wish that they could have a tie. I can only remember one time seeing a tie in a series category, and that was in the daytime Emmys when I think it was Guiding Light and Young and the Restless tied for best series, and that's like one in a million shot. But yeah, you know, I do want to say, you know, we've talked a lot about the beginning of the show and the end of the show and themes and everything, but you know, we haven't talked a lot about the middle of the show. You know, the stuff where she worked at B. Altman and she went up to the Catskills and Susie was carrying the plunger around and kind of got addicted to the plunger and couldn't get rid of it. And her friend that worked at the – Susie's friend that worked at the Gaslight that ends up dying because the actor passed away, you know – and then the we briefly touched on the two mobsters, and they were, you know, by the end they were not a small part of the show. You know, they helped fund Susie. They were a big part of the reason why Joel ends up in trouble. Why you know, Midge keeps having to do the work that she keeps having to do. And the Shy Baldwin stuff, you know, we touched on that, but that was a story that started at the end of season 2, really dominated season 3, and its ramifications were felt throughout seasons 4 and 5. And then, of course, you know, again, in season 5, we have the Glenn Ford show storyline, which, you know, I wasn't sure what to think of Ford. But by the end of the show, yeah, he's an asshole. he's an asshole, and his wife is awesome.
Yes, his only saving grace is he knows that.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
Yep. But you know, but that actor did a tremendous job there. But he was also great on Veep as well. So, you know, that was. That didn't surprise me when I saw him turn on Paris. I was like, oh, this should be pretty good.
And that character really is another thing that could have gone very wrong, right? That's supposed to be Johnny Carson. There's no way that's not Johnny Carson. And
you could have gotten away with having it
outside of probably the Carson estate suing. You could have gotten away with doing that. That, you know, to have Jack Parr be real and a part of the show. That's kind of a bold move. To pull that off is impressive.
Yeah. Man, that roast episode where you saw what Susie did to get Teledano off the show and get Mike in place of him. Oh Lord. Yep. But No, that it's just such a great show. I mean, we could do another half hour, 40 minutes, but I don't want to belabor points. I wanted to keep this around an hour and a half, hour and 40, and that's about where we're at. So I do want to say goodnight and wrap it up. Once again, I want to thank everyone out there for listening. I want to thank the two of you for coming in and participating. I do want to remind everyone that, yes, we will be back next week with our episode on Barry, so please join us. And with that, we will count down 1, 2, 3. Good night, folks.
Thank you, and good night.